The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. I am Michael Scavarla of Penn State University, your host for today. And today, we are going to be talking about scale insects. And I know some of you entomologists are probably groaning like, oh, scales, why? They're so boring. And as an undergrad and even into my graduate degree, I probably would have agreed with you because they just sit there and don't move. But scale insects are actually really interesting. And to help sell you that they are interesting and to talk about what scale insects are, we have a special guest on our show today, Scott Schneider of the USDA ARS Systematic Entomology Laboratory. Scott, can you say hello to the folks and kind of introduce yourself?
Hello. Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm excited to talk about scales, the group that I've decided to dedicate my career to. So I don't think that they're boring at all. I think they're actually very charming. I work, as you said, for the Systematic Entomology Laboratory. Before I started there, I did my graduate work at Towson University, where I earned my master's degree working with John LaPola. And after that, I got my PhD at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, working with Benjamin Normark.
Before we dive into all the intricacies of what scale insects are and why they're so interesting, I want to start kind of broad. So can you explain to us, like, what exactly is a scale insect? What do they look like? What group do they occur in? You know, for those that don't know, what are they?
Sure. Yeah. So I'll give you the answer that I give my family and friends first when they ask, like, what is a scale insect? It's like, scale insects are these tiny, weird little blobs that turn out to be insects. They feed on plants. They poop out sugar water often, is the case, and they're very good at making lots of babies. So to be more technical, they are members of Hemiptera, so they have piercing, sucking mouth parts. They typically feed on phloem or xylem sap of plants, but then sometimes they also just feed on cell contents of plants. So, like, the largest family of scale insects are the armored scales, Diaspidae, and they don't feed on fluids of the plants. They actually empty out cell contents of the plants. They are within the infraorder Coccomorpha, and that falls within Sternorhynchia. So, Sternorhynchia are a group that includes, along with the scales, aphids, whiteflies, psyllids. And one of the defining features of the group is that their mouth parts are located on their thorax instead of on their head.
So they've got, like, mouth parts that are coming out of their sternum and not their face.
Yes, exactly.
That's very weird.
It is very weird, yes. And so, generally speaking, scale insects, my opinion of scale insects is that they like to challenge the conventions. So they like to challenge the definition of what an insect is. If you think about, like, what defines an adult insect, it's usually that they have a three-segmented body, they have wings, they have three pairs of legs, they have two antennae. Scale insects, in all of those respects, can challenge those conventions. So they don't have three-segmented bodies. They, like I said, they're just sort of a blob. You can still see the remnants of body segmentation. We still talk about segmentation of, you know, the abdomen, thorax, head, etc. But just picture this as a very simplified body plan. They tend to be an oval, just an oval little bag. And adult females never have wings. Adult males sometimes have wings. They sometimes do and sometimes do not have legs. as the first instar, the very first life stage, we call that the crawler. So the crawlers do tend to have the, you know, six legs, as you would expect an insect to have. And usually they are the life stage that will wander around and settle down and start feeding. So they're the dispersive stage. And many scales after the crawler stage will lose their legs and will never move again. And others will retain their legs throughout life and are still mobile, limited to a limited degree, but still mobile. And then in terms of antennae, yes, they all have antennae, but they kind of stretch the definition of what an antenna can be. There are some armored scales that basically just have this tiny little remnant of what used to be an antenna with a ceta sticking off of it. So in all of the ways that you typically think of an insect, the scale insects like to play around with what it means to be an insect.
When I think of scales, almost inevitably, I think of the armored scales, diaspidids. How representative are armored scales of the rest of scale insects? Are most other scales like making a hard scale that they hide under? Are most other scales like losing their legs and not moving? Like, what's the morphological diversity like within coccomorphs, the scales broadly? Because I think most people will think of hard scales and maybe soft scales. Are those really representative of like what most scales are? Like, where are they most scales? Are diaspidids like representing, you know, the bulk of diversity anyhow? So we don't need to worry about some of these other groups.
Well, so the armored scales make up about 1/3 of the biodiversity of scale insects. They are the largest family. When I hear non-experts on the group talk about scales, I usually hear them talk about kind of three informal subdivisions. There's like the armored scales or hard scales, soft scales, which typically is the family Coccidae, and then mealybugs. And mealybugs is used very broadly and generally for any scale insects that produce this sort of light, fluffy, waxy material on their bodies. Soft scales tend to have more of a, what would you call it, like a resinous cover that is it's sometimes transparent and not very visible at all. Sometimes they have dense, thick, white wax that's very clearly identifiable as wax. And those tend to be the basic types of wax and resin that you'll see in scales, but there's more to it than that. So for example, what comes to mind would be like lac insects in family Coriidae. They have a thick resin that they produce. And that resinous material has actually been an important commodity that humans have used for a very long time. So for example, shellac originally comes from the resin of lac insects. And I think most shellac these days is actually like a synthetic material, but the resins are still used in a lot of really interesting ways from lac insects, and just the waxy products from a bunch of different insects are used in various products in various ways these days. I actually, if you're interested, I marked out a little excerpt from a book to give you an idea of what that looks like.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I'm showing you or reading to you an excerpt from the Encyclopedia of Scale Insects, which is a book that came out recently. It was edited by Damian Kondo and Jillian Watson. They did a really fantastic job with this book. So I'm talking to you about a section from the beneficial scale insects, discussing their resins and waxes. And we're talking about a soft scale called the Pella scale. And they mentioned that Pella wax is used for the insulation of electrical cables, anti-corrosive coating on ammunition, as a shining agent for paper, a polishing ingredient for automobiles, tires, leather products, and wood furniture, and for coating pills, making candles, and on and on and on.
I didn't know any of that. So that, I learned something today. That's really cool.
It's wild. It's I would never even think that they would, you would find that in like insulation for electrical cables and such. It's just
insane. Or that it's still used today. Like if you told me, yeah, they used this in the 1930s, I'd be like, oh yeah, sure, that makes sense. And now we've got some, like shellac, we've got some synthetic alternative that we've moved away from natural scale products. Mm-hmm. So that's cool that it's even still being used today.
Yeah, it's still used in furniture, and I know it's used in musical instruments too, like guitars.
So you kind of got at it. You mentioned that diaspidids, the hard scales, make up about a third of scale diversity. Mm-hmm. Before we get too far into what is a scale, what does the diversity look like? So, you know, how many species totals across all of Coccomorpha? How many families are there? And kind of going off of that, then where are they distributed? Are there any like biodiversity hotspots? Can you give us an idea of what kind of diversity we're talking about here?
Sure. Yeah. So there are 36 extant families of scale insects, and that's comprised of 1,180 genera and just under 8,500 species. And in terms of where they're distributed, you can find them basically everywhere except for the poles, but their diversity follows sort of a typical pattern that you might expect, where they're most diverse around the tropics, and then they become less and less diverse as you approach the poles.
I didn't prep you for this, but are there any groups that kind of show the opposite, where they're more diverse in temperate areas compared to the tropics? Because I know some groups will do that. Or scales just the typical, everybody's in the tropics, and then it's just the weird ones that get up here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure, but I would suspect that it's probably true that most of them are present in the tropics and most diverse in the tropics, but and then start to taper off as you reach the poles. It's possible that there are exceptions to that, but off the top of my head, they don't come to mind.
So is there anything else that we should know that we haven't talked about that's unique to their, say, life history or morphology?
Well, in terms of life history, I would emphasize they have some defining characteristics of scale insects is that they have strong sexual dimorphism. So I hinted at this earlier. Females are a blob throughout their whole life. You know, from their very first instar all the way through adulthood, they tend to just be sort of oval or circular in shape. Whereas males are quite different. They begin their life in the same way as crawlers. They go through some intermediate, immature stages where they are sort of these blobby things. But one thing that's interesting about scale insects is that they have independently evolved a form of metamorphosis. And recall, these are falling within the hemimetabolous insects, which are not supposed to undergo metamorphosis. But scale insects have this unique form of metamorphosis where the males go through a series of pupal stages and then emerge as something that's more recognizable as an insect. So their body plan seems to have more clearly defined segmentation. They often have wings, and they often look nothing like the female. So I think in the past, people struggled, and still to this day, struggle to associate males of a species with females, and you know, often using molecular data is the way to help overcome that challenge. But morphologically, they look nothing alike.
I know I've picked up male scale insects in, say, malaise traps, rarely in like Berlazy samples as well. And the first couple times I ran across them, I looked at this thing. It's like, I know this is some kind of Hemiptera, mm-hmm. maybe. But it was weird, like knowing insect diversity, like not being able to get something to family because they're just so weird and unexpected when you find them, because you don't expect to find a flying scale in your malaise trap.
Yeah. And I don't even like looking at the males, to be honest with you. I really love the simplicity and the blobbiness of the females. And I look at the males and I'm like, there's too much going on. They're too busy. I don't want to look at this thing.
So that's a great segue into how do we identify these things? What do you have a scale insect in front of you. Mm-hmm. What do you do to it to identify it? What kind of features are you looking at? And then tying back into the males, like, are males useful for ID? Like, would you ever like identify males outside of having females too?
Yeah. So when I receive requests from the public for identification, they often start with wanting to send me pictures from the field of what they saw. And I have to explain to them, in order for me to reliably identify a scale insect to species, I need specimens of adult females so that I can clear their body of its contents and slide mount them. It's really the only way to get a good identification of a scale insect is a slide mounted specimen, preferably an adult female. So all of the other life stages to a point could be useful when it comes to identification, but the taxonomy of scale insects is based entirely off of the adult females. Almost all of the identification guides are based off of adult females. So for me to make an identification off of any other life stages, the literature is so spotty, it's really hard to make confident identifications on any of those stages, not just adult males, but immature stages as well. There are some groups where workers have done a bit of, you know, identification work and publishing on, you know, how to make identifications for other life stages. But for the most part, you need the adult female.
So do different scale insects then have different life cycles? Like they'll have one generation or multiple generations a year. And does that affect identification? Like if you get a sample in, is there a chance there just won't be any adult females in there because it's, say, the wrong time of year?
It is possible. Yeah, it comes up. There are species that can have multiple generations within, you know, in a temperate climate within one season. You could have one, maybe two generations. And then as you get more towards the tropics, of course, they just sort of have this rotating, you know, circulating period of just reproducing all the time, and all generations all life stages will be available most of the time. So occasionally it does come up that people will submit a specimen to me or a collection of specimens to me for identification that were gathered within the off season in North America. So from the, you know, fall to early spring. And if there are no adult females present, what I'll often do is give them the close approximation. You know, I can tell you what family it is. I can tell you what genus it is. I can say, you know, based off of the host and the locality, this is probably what it is. We can look in the national collection and kind of compare, do we have immatures from the suspected species to compare against and make a more confident identification. I can give you an example. So I recently had a request from, what was it, Minnesota, I think, sent me specimens of armored scales that were infesting Christmas trees. And they wanted to know what species it was. And I was able to make an identification. It was Dynaspidiotis abetus, which is a known armored scale that will infest Christmas trees and other pines. This was a species of Abies, I believe. And all that they had were immature specimens, second instar specimens. So it was challenging. I always like when I get an adult female, it makes things so much easier. But in this case, we're still able to give them a good ID based off of the immatures.
So we've kind of hinted at it, talking about how these things feed on plants. You get specimens that are coming in that people want to identify because they're pests on trees. I think the way most people interface with scales, and maybe besides the fact that they kind of break these rules of being insects, the reason people don't like them is they are frequently plant pests. Mm-hmm. Of the 8,500 or so species, do you know how many of them are plant pests? Do they follow similar patterns where with like mosquitoes, say we've got 80 some species here in Pennsylvania, but there's only a handful that regularly bite people and are pests? Is it similar with scales? Like most of them are out there just doing their thing and it's only the few that are pests? Or is it like most hard scales are pests on something to somebody?
It's the former. So most scale insects are just out there doing their thing, and their populations tend to be controlled by natural enemies, etc. And the exception are about the 8% of scale species that are considered pests. And I would mention that something is a pest when we decide that it's inconvenient and harmful. And so we're the ones labeling them pests. It's not like it's actually an attribute of their biology. And it can be circumstantial too. So there are some species that would be considered a pest in one part of the world and beneficial in a different part of the world, where if they're being used as a biological control agent, for example. So there are examples of scales that have been introduced into a range where a non-native plant has taken hold and has grown out of control. We can, people have introduced a scale insect that, likes to feed on that plant and helps to suppress that population and rein it in so that the invasive plant isn't causing so much damage in the introduced range.
I guess I should have qualified pest. I'm glad that you did, because I agree. And even I get scale insects as IDs as well sometimes. And, if a plant comes in with just one scale on it, I'll tell the client, like, I found this scale insect, but there isn't a big enough population on here to worry about it, but you should monitor it in case it outbreaks. Mm-hmm. Like when it outbreaks, that's when it's a problem and you should control it. But until then, until you see signs of decline in your plant, just watch out for it. It may never outbreak. It may not do anything but have a couple of individuals on there and do their scale thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing about scales that they're actually kind of just all over the place very commonly, and they're not known very well because most of the time you don't have outbreak populations that are causing issues. It's the occasional outbreak populations that end up causing a lot of trouble. I will assure you they can cause quite a lot of trouble in the range of billions of dollars worth of loss and expenses in management every year.
Yeah, that makes me think here, at least, of elongated hemlock scale getting on hemlocks. We always think of hemlock woolly adelgid being the main pest here of hemlocks, but even when you get good control of the adelgids, the elongated hemlock scales can still kill your tree because they outbreak. And then they right. get on every other conifer in the area too.
Yeah, and it's a 1-2 punch for the hemlocks because they're already, suffering due to hemlock woolly adelgid, and, here's this other thing causing them harm as well.
So that's kind of what scales are. Thank you for kind of bringing us up to speed.
Sure.
I'd like to transition now and talk about, you've mentioned it, but really talk about like, what do you do at the USDA? Kind of what services do you offer? Who are your main clientele? And just what is your job there?
Yeah, sure. So my primary role at the USDA, my job title is research entomologist. So I conduct research on the systematics and taxonomy of scale insects. And I provide service in a number of ways. So one thing that we've mentioned is that I provide identification service. The primary group that I serve in that aspect is our sister agency within USDA, APHIS, which is Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, is what APHIS stands for. And so I serve as a national identifier for APHIS for armored scale insects. We have a team of people who are working at the same location where I am, who divide the labor when it comes to scale insects overall. So Greg Evans provides identification for all of the other scale families. And I provide, you know, identifications for the Diaspidae. And then Ian Stocks also serves as like a person who provides coverage for the both of us. So if he is another expert on scale insects, and he contributes to the identification load as well. And so what happens, just to give listeners an idea of how that plays out. So APHIS kind of serves as the first line of defense as material is being imported into the country. So they're inspecting material to make sure that we're not importing species that we don't want here. And they have various ports all around the country that employ identifiers who are really astoundingly good at making identifications all across the diversity of insects. I'm always, you know, amazingly impressed with their breadth of knowledge when it comes to species identification. So they will be, they're the ones who make a first pass at providing an identification on something that was found on material being imported into the country. And then if they don't have the authority to provide the species level identification, or if they're just not certain, they will submit that specimen to a specialist, to one of the national identifiers. So that would be me for any armored scales that they're uncertain of, or just don't have the authority to make that identification on. So I'll provide that final ID so that we can keep track of what species are coming into the country, from where, on what commodities, so on and so forth.
And as you're doing these IDs, like they come in, is there, say, a ship in port waiting to unload goods? Like, do the goods that the scales are found on, do they get held up? And so these IDs you're doing are urgent because they need done now, so these things can get offloaded if it's, you know, a scale we don't mind being brought in, or it's a pest we don't want in, so these need to be destroyed before like the ship can dock or whatever.
That's right. That's often the case. They have a ship that's sitting at a port, and they are paying port fees, and you know, it's sort of holding up the flow, the economic flow. And so they need a quick turnaround on what the species is that was encountered at the port, so that they can make a decision on what to do about it. So, you know, is it something that we can allow into the country? It's already here. It's not a problem. Is it something that we cannot allow into the country? We either need to treat it or we need to turn it away. It's basically the spectrum of decisions that they have available to them.
Outside of APHIS, are there any other clients? Like, I know I've sent you stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, am I the only person at a, say, state university that's sending you stuff? Or do you get it from all over the country? Or who are some of your other clients or stakeholders?
Yeah, so I do have the occasional, researchers at universities who are representing the state often, or just state agricultural departments will submit material to me if they think that it's a new state record or like a new host that it hasn't been seen on before. I will receive requests from them. I receive requests from active or potential collaborators on research projects. So, you know, just professors working at universities who want, you know, an identification to be able to move forward with a research project. Like, we're finding this species on this commodity, and you know, it's causing problems, we want to make sure that we have the species name right, because all of the downstream biological information is tied to a species name. So having the right name is really critical and crucial. You need to know who it is that you're talking about before you can talk about them any further. I also receive requests from international partners as well. So other federal agencies will occasionally reach out and ask for assistance with making identifications, or just researchers from universities from around the world could submit material to me occasionally as well.
Do you have, I'm sure you probably do. Do you know how many samples you're dealing with every year? Is it hundreds, thousands, dozens of thousands?
Not quite that much. For APHIS, I think I kind of average maybe around 150 to 200 urgent identifications per year. And then in terms of, you know, the other, like all, you know, state agencies, researchers, et cetera, it's probably maybe another 20 to 50 per year kind of deal.
Okay. That seems not as overwhelming as I was kind of expecting.
Yeah. Manageable.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I was covering all of the scale insects, it would be a totally different story.
I was going to ask, so you mentioned that Greg takes all of the other scales. Is it like evenly divided between diaspidids and everything else, or is it you get more than he does? How does that break out?
I'm sure that he gets more than I do. He works for USDA APHIS, so his primary role is as a national identifier. And so he's taking on more of the burden. And I'm really the person who's helping to kind of relieve some burden from him by covering the largest family, the Diaspididae, and make both of our workload more manageable.
So at USDA, you work with or have access to the Smithsonian collection. Can you tell us how we think about the Smithsonian as, you know, a big museum? How big is their scale collection? What does it look like? What kind of taxonomic coverage are we talking? Do they have examples of things from all over the world? Most scales are represented, or is it mostly North America? What is this nice resource that you've got access to while you're working on your scale IDs?
Yeah, so this is the other major service component of my position, is that I get to serve as the curator of the National Scale Insect Collection, which is a huge honor. I'm really excited to be able to do that in my career. So the national collections are housed at our USDA facility in Beltsville, Maryland. So this is just a little bit outside of DC, to the northeast, close to University of Maryland in College Park. The scale insect collection is mostly comprised of slide-mounted specimens, because that's what we need in order to make identifications. So we have around 170,000 slides in that collection alone. And then in addition to that, we have both dried and ethanol preserved specimens, which numbers in the who knows sort of category, because you can have just an envelope or a box or a vial with many, many specimens in there. And it's not even like someone has counted how many specimens are there. So in terms of specimens overall, we recently had to do a move of our collections. We had to move to a different building on our campus. And we got some insight into how many specimens, you know, the Smithsonian thought that we were moving at that time. And it was quoted at about 4.5 million specimens for all of the collections that are housed at our site. So it's not just the scale insects. Like you mentioned, the aphids are there as well. You were working with the aphid collection. We also have thrips and psyllids, white flies, and mites are the main collections at our site. And so 4.5 million specimens among all of those collections. But I don't think that is taking the dried and ethanol preserved collections into account at all, because I would bet that we would at least double that number, if not more, if you considered all of those collections as well. And then, so in terms of primary type collections for the scale insects, we have a very large holding of the primary types. So it's just shy, I think, of 2,000 primary types. And then the collection overall represents about 55% of the world's species diversity. So it's a major collection. I think the only rival that might have a larger collection and represent more diversity could be the British Museum, but I'm not really sure how it stacks up. One of the two of us has the largest collection in the world, which is part of the reason why we get requests from all over the place to aid with identification, because the natural history collections are an important resource for being able to make those identifications. And we have resources available to us that many other countries in the world don't have. So we're happy to provide that service and provide that assistance.
I'm still reeling over the fact that you have 2,000 primary types and there's only 8,500 scales. You've got a quarter of the world's type collection. For the listeners that aren't aware of it, a primary type in this case is the specimen that a species is described from. So this is the specimen that you point to and say, this is what we mean when we say this is the species. And that's the thing that you go refer back to. Anytime you look at any other specimen, you would be comparing it either directly or hypothetically to that type specimen. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's really cool. I guess I hadn't realized before just how many there are.
Yeah, quite a few.
So you've mentioned that you do research in addition mm-hmm. to your service and identifications. I haven't really been up on what you've been doing research-wise since I left, 7 years ago now.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel like it's been that long.
Hard to believe.
Jeez, it makes me feel old. So what are you doing research-wise now? What are your interests and, you know, what are you up to?
Yeah. So the main drive of my research program in recent years has been focusing on taxonomic and phylogenetic work on armored scale insects. That's one of the major groups that I work on. But I've also been doing a lot of work on root mealybugs as well. And that ties into an NSF project that I'm involved in on relationships between root mealybugs and a group of ants called Acropyga ants. And it's a really fascinating story. So Acropyga have a group of mealybugs called, they're from the family Xenococcidae, that are their primary associates. So Acropyga always associate with these Xenococcids, and in turn, Xenococcids are only found in association with Acropyga. The ants attend to them essentially like livestock. So they raise them within their nests, and they herd them back and forth between nest chambers and root systems to feed on the, you know, on the phloem or xylem of the roots. And I mentioned earlier that scale insects like to poop out sugar water. So their waste is called honeydew, and it's essentially just excess sugary water that they are receiving from the phloem sap. So in order for them to receive enough nitrogen from this nitrogen poor food source, they have to drink a lot and exude a lot of excess sugary water. And this happens to be something that ants really love. And so they raise them like livestock to collect their honeydew. And what's fascinating is that the way that new Acropyga colonies are established are that an Acropyga queen, when she's getting ready to leave for her mating flight and start her own colony, she will pick a pregnant mealybug from the colony and grab it between her mandibles and bring it with her on her mating flight. So both individuals serve as a foundress for the next generation. The ant is the foundress for the population of ants. The pregnant mealybug that she brings along with her is the foundress for the next generation of mealybugs. This goes back to my master's work. It's actually the system that I started with and sort of grew up with in my career. And so I've been very happy to be able to continue working on this group in recent years. I was doing some other work recently on the Roseau-Cain scale, which maybe you've heard of. So Roseau-Cain scale was a, it's an eclaireted that was, which is a flat grass scale that was introduced into the country probably right around 2015 or so. It was first detected and noticed in 2016. And it is feeding on Phragmites australis in Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana. So Phragmites australis is an interesting plant because in most of the country, we might consider this to be a pesky plant that we don't want around. The European variety of Phragmites has spread around the country in various parts and has caused all sorts of issues. But in this part of Louisiana, it is a very, very important plant. And there's actually multiple varieties of Phragmites australis in this part of the country, some of them native. And it basically provides the foundation for the marshes there. It prevents erosion. It helps to limit damage from major storms, hurricane events. It structures the channels. There's a major shipping channel that goes right up this strait into the Mississippi River. And it helps to provide stabilize the shipping channels. And there's also oil infrastructure that kind of relies on these marshes to help protect their infrastructure. So really, really important cluster of Phragmites australis. And this flat grass scale was causing, or at least contributing to a massive die-off of large stands of Phragmites australis. And so there was a bit of a hurried effort to figure out, what is this thing? Where did it come from? What opportunities do we have to control it, et cetera, et cetera. So I was involved in the early stages of this work. I provided the identification of the pest. It's called Nipona clarida biwakoensis. And I worked with partners from all around the world I worked with a bunch of partners from USDA APHIS, from Louisiana State University, and with collaborators from Eastern Asia, the native range, to narrow down where we think the source population of Roseau-Cain scale that has been introduced into the United States came from, because that helps downstream with figuring out what natural enemies in the native range help to control it, and what would be good targets for us to use and introduce into Louisiana to help control the outbreak of Roseau-Cain scales. So to give you an idea of what I mean by outbreak, like a single cane can have upwards of 2,000 individuals on it.
Wow.
Very, very heavy infestation.
I've got so many questions, because when you said that it got on Phragmites, my initial thought was like, thank goodness, something to control this stupid invasive grass.
Right.
Because I guess for listeners, when I was working at USDA in Beltsville, I worked on cattail aphids, and it was great because cattails are all over the place, except a lot of the cattail stands were being invaded by Phragmites. And so it's outcompeting, native plants and kind of changing marshes here. So I was excited, like, yeah, great, let's kill it. But it sounds like maybe that's not the case down south.
They want to save their Phragmites in that part of the country. It's critical.
Yeah.
And actually, ironically, the European variety is most resistant to Rosocaine scale. So in terms of finding a variety that you might be able to replant and have more robust hardy stands is actually the variety that everyone hates and is trying to get rid of.
Oh, that was going to be my follow-up, is how does the European variety withstand the infestations? That I guess the other follow-up I had doesn't matter so much. Like, will this scale be able to survive up here up north, or is this going to be too cold for it? But if the invasive variety's resistant to feeding, I'm not sure it will matter very much, even if it can.
Yeah, and as part of the work that we did, I didn't do this component, but we did Maxent, like climate matching, to kind of see what is the potential range of the, you know, Rosocaine scale in the U.S. And it does kind of stick to the Gulf Coast, seems to be, you know, where it would do well. You would expect it would do well in the U.S. It has been spreading, so they've found it. Subsequently, the initial discovery was in Louisiana. They found it in Texas soon after that. And now, most recently, they've been finding that it's spreading into Mississippi, into Alabama. So, you know, I suspect soon enough it'll be in Florida as well.
That's a good place to ask, because I don't think I asked it before. Scale insects typically don't move, or don't move very much as adults. The males are maybe flying around to find females. If they're not moving, how are they spread? Is it just the crawlers, like crawling plant to plant? Like, how are they getting place to place, and how are these Rosocaine scales moving so quickly?
Yeah, so the majority of crawlers will probably crawl just locally. They'll, you know, settle on the same host plant that mom was on, or maybe an adjacent host plant. But they can be more widely dispersed through wind or through phoresis. And so phoresis means hitching a ride on something that is more mobile than they are, like a fly, you know, for example. And then in the marshes, you might also expect that they could be spread through wave action, things like that. A big splash could send a tiny little crawler flying, and maybe it gets picked up by a gust of wind and spreads further that way. They have been working very hard to communicate with the local community and let them know, like, if you are riding a boat through this area, you could be picking up crawlers as you go through. Try to, you know, be conscious of cleaning your boat off and you know, helping to reduce and prevent the spread of Rosocaine scale by being aware of that and trying to prevent transferring crawlers through human activity. But human activity is another big way that scale insects are spread around globally. You know, as we were mentioning, in terms of monitoring ports and imports, scale insects are among the most invasive insects in the world. Probably scales and aphids are sort of at the top there. And a lot of it is because they're very small and cryptic. You might not recognize that it is an insect that you're looking at, and they're stuck to the plant. And so if you're moving the plant around, you're likely to move the scale around as well. And they were some of the earliest species or groups that were transported all around the world on goods, to the point where certain species, it's kind of hard to say for certain where they originated from without doing some like phylogenetic work to kind of see, like, okay, well, who are their closest relatives and where are they from? Like, oh, okay, so it probably came from this region originally. But by the time we started paying attention, it was already so widespread around the world that it was kind of considered cosmopolitan.
Could any of these things, these cosmopolitan species that, you know, maybe have a broad host range, you mentioned that they get picked up in the wind, Could they be truly cosmopolitan? Some of these things, like they're getting picked up in like updrafts in Europe and dropped down in North America or something. Could they be really like actually cosmopolitan, or is this mostly just human transport and we don't know?
I think it's mostly human transport. I think it's possible that could happen, but a bit less likely. I will mention, you know, I was astounded when I say that scale insects are basically everywhere except for the poles. There's an example that I saw of this tiny little island that I've never even heard of called Marion Island. It's about midway between South Africa and Antarctica, and it has an armored scale that's been reported from there. It's like, where in the world did this armored scale come from? How did it get there? I don't know that this is a stopping off point for, you know, shipping. So you might suspect, okay, maybe it did get there by just blowing around in a gust of wind and getting lucky and landing in the right spot.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking about the wave action thing, and I imagine like waves splash up and catch crawlers, and most of those crawlers are going to die. But if 1 in 100 survives and lands on the planet, that's all you need. So yeah, like with this island, if 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 survives, but happens to land where it needs to be, that's all you need to colonize that island eventually.
Yeah. And if it's plant material that's being, you know, transported through wave action or whatever, and the scales just happen to survive that activity, then there and land on, you know, an island or a different location, there's the opportunity for them to establish in a new place.
I'm just going to imagine scales traversing the world now. Is there any other, before we move on, is there any other research that you want to talk about? Or have we covered everything that you're kind of doing right now?
We covered the major things. I'm working, you know, I work generally on developing identification guides to help researchers around the world. And, you know, that would include stakeholders like you who are trying to identify specimens that you come across in your work, helping USDA APHIS port identifiers in their day-to-day work, and just generally any researchers who are interested in working on scale insects all around the world. Those identification guides are useful and helpful to them.
I would like to thank you for the help that you have given me. I probably send in at least one or two specimens a year of things that I just cannot figure out. So I appreciate that the service is available and that you're, you know, responsive, because that's not always the case.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm always happy to. Yeah, keep them coming, and results in some good collaborations.
Yeah, for sure. The last question I had, and if you don't have anything to say about it, that's fine, and I'll just cut this bit. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite group of scales are orthoceans, because they're one of the few groups that I would consistently see when I worked in leaf litter. We'd get leaf litter, run it through a Berlaisi funnel to drive all of the insects and mites out. And I was working on mites at the time, so that was great. But I would consistently find these little white fluffy scales that kind of don't look like other scales because they've got legs and can move around. And I didn't really dive into them much further because I wasn't working on them at the time, but I thought they looked really cool. And it was neat that I was getting these things that were, you know, not typically seen. At least I didn't think so. Do you have any opinions on them? What can you tell me anything interesting about orthoceans? Is anybody working on them? Do they matter?
Well, so I will say, when you sent me the question in advance, I thought, oh, that's so funny. Why orthoceans? Really? but I do agree. I mean, I think that they are interesting in that they do appear to be one of the more mobile groups of scales. I think partially, so in terms of how do they relate to other scale families, they fall at the base of the scale tree. So they are more like ancestral looking than some of the more derived groups. Like armored scales would be a very derived group that look very odd. You know, they never have legs as adult females, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that is fun and interesting about orthesids, I think, is the fact that they carry their ovisac with them. It's sort of glued to their body. So if you've ever seen like Insignorthesia insignis. So this species has this large dramatic ovisac that is attached to the posterior end. And the way that I describe it is it almost looks like a playground slide that is coming off of their butt. and it looks like it's made out of meringue. It's like this bright white color. It's very striking. So in terms of like an insect that is visually interesting to see and maybe more charismatic, that's a good example. Like orthesids could be a really good example. Just for the fact that they, instead of attaching their ovisac to a plant like most insects would, they've just decided to carry it along with them for the ride.
Fun. Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me today. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the fact that you even answered my weird orthesid question.
Keep them coming. There's all sorts of weird things about scale insects I'm happy to talk about. We didn't even get to one of the weirdest things I was thinking of maybe mentioning. I don't know if you want to include this or not, but
sure, let's keep going.
In terms of weird stuff, when it comes to scale insects, I'll just fire off a couple of things. they have extreme diversity of genetic and sex determination systems. Scale insects have actually seemed to be kind of like nature's little experiment on sex determination systems. And if you consider the diversity that they have, it is greater than if you took all the rest of insects together. they are the only group of insects that have a hermaphrodite. There's a famous scale, Iceria purchasi. It was one of the It's the cottony cushion scale is the common name. And it was one of the early pest species that actually, in addition to a couple of armored scale species, it sort of inspired countries to establish their first quarantine programs to prevent new invasions of species because it was so damaging. It was damaging citrus industry all over the world.
That's the one that C.V. Reilly sent his assistant to Australia to get ladybugs for, right?
Yes, that's right.
Perfect.
So, okay. Iceria purchasi, cottony cushion scale, is a hermaphrodite. It is an individual that has both ovaries and a testis, and it fertilizes its own eggs using this testis.
Can they mate? Multiple individuals? Or are they just mating with themselves? Is there like sperm transfer ever?
There is the opportunity. So most of the offspring that they produce are, you know, what are essentially females, but it is this hermaphrodite that has this male like sperm producing tissue that is inherited through the maternal lineage. But they also do rarely produce males as well, which develop from unfertilized ova. So they have the opportunity to mate with males. And from what I've seen, I haven't researched this myself, but the research that I have seen, at least the hypothesis was that when they mate with a male, the male can supplant this testis and actually introduce his own for fertilization of subsequent generations.
That seems, without looking at it into it more, that seems like a really good way to have both the benefits of being, of having asexual reproduction, where you can make lots of babies without having to find a mate, but also having just enough sexual reproduction in there and just enough of genetic mixing that you don't say get wiped out by some kind of pathogen because you're all, you know, have the same genetic structure.
I would agree.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and it kind of goes along with the weird diversity of their genetic systems in general, where they have this strong feminizing trend. So most scale insects have paternal genome elimination. So even when they are mating with a male, male offspring only pass on maternally inherited genes. They don't, for the most part, they don't express and they don't pass on genes that they inherit through the paternal lineage. And so often what happens is that any of the chromosomes they inherit from dad become heterochromatinized and silenced. And at some point they become eliminated. And there's multiple versions of when they become eliminated that come up among the scales. They also have true haplodiploidy, where females will develop from fertilized eggs and males will develop from unfertilized eggs. And they have parthenogenesis evolving multiple times independently as well.
Oh, that's really cool. So that seems like a really neat system to dive into if you're interested in the evolution of like these kind of genetic reproductive systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Nature's already been conducting the experiment. You just have to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea about any of that. That's really cool.
Yeah. So I have one more weird thing to tell you before.
Yes, please. Before I'm all about weird scale
facts. If you want to hear it. Okay. So this is my selling on why scale insects are cool and why they're so interesting. So there is also a family of scales called Styctococcidae. And there is a species that they're located in Africa. They tend to feed on like melons and tubers is what you'll often find them on. There is one species of Styctococcus that has a placenta, essentially. Yes. So
I'm sorry, what?
The males never have mouth parts throughout their entire development. They receive all of their nutrition in the embryonic stage through a placenta-like organ that the adult females have. So they provision their males through this like convergently, independently evolved placenta and send them off on their way. They live their entire life never feeding after that.
So do they go through all of the nymphal stages then and just don't feed, or are they coming out like almost fully formed males that then go mate?
They go through all of their nymphal stages to adult stage, never having mouth parts and never feeding.
That's bizarre. Yeah. Like you think about things like Saturniid moths where they become giant caterpillars and they get so big because they don't feed as adults. And so they've got to live their whole life off of like the resources that they consumed as larvae. But I've never heard of an insect that gets all of their nutrients like as an embryo like that and then never feeds as a nymph or an adult. That's weird.
Yeah. And just in terms of like the evolution of a placenta was a major, you know, transition in mammalian evolution. And here's something that's very analogous to it popping up in a scale insect.
Do you? So some of the work that I've been doing here has been on deer keds. They're hippobosid flies. Mm. And they're weird too, because they've got internal larvae and they have kind of a placenta and produce like a milk inside their uterus. Oh, nice. So they've also got like this weird internal development like that. Mm. And I always like, you think about mammals and the development of the placenta is kind of like what allowed us to diversify. Like it was one of the key adaptations. I always look at hippobosids and now these scales, like why didn't that take off?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Why hasn't this, I mean, are we just kind of too early? If we check back in a few million years, will it be a different story? I don't know.
Yeah, that's really weird and cool.
Huh. Yeah. So those were my fun stories to share with you.
No, I'm glad you did, because I didn't know any of that to the point that I didn't know to ask about it. So I really appreciate that. I'm going to think about scale placentas for a while now.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, I think we're going to wrap it up. So Scott, thank you for coming on today and talking about scale insects, hopefully getting people excited about scales, because, you know, like I said, a little bit tongue in cheek in the beginning, you know, you see scale insects mounted on a slide in your insect taxonomy class and people think maybe they're kind of boring, but as we've learned today, they're not, once you get to know them a little bit better. So I really appreciate you coming on and telling our listeners about that and kind of telling them about yourself and your job. Do you have anything you want to plug before we sign off? Any social media that you might be on, or websites, or where can people find you if they need to find you? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Okay. Well, I'm very happy, first of all, to have been here. Thank you very much for inviting me. You can find information about my research on the USDA website for our lab group. So if you look up USDA ARS Systematic Entomology Lab, you can find our lab group and see the diversity of work that all of the scientists in our unit are doing. And you can find more about the research that I'm doing there. I avoid social media, so you won't find me on there.
I have slowly been weaning myself off of social media as well.
Yeah, I had Facebook years ago, but it's gone now.
Yeah, I deleted Facebook and then recreated it for a research project and have not gone back. I still have a Twitter, if maybe or maybe I won't get on it again ever, but that's at mscavarla36. You can find the show, ArthroPod, at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can also find the show on any of the major podcatchers. And with that, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you on the next ArthroPod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the ArthroPod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.